horrible reality a few months later, perhaps a few years later, perhaps not until these little boys with dirty faces that Jean-Marie could see, peering over the wooden gate in front of the door, grew into men. Wearing torn straw hats, their cheeks rosy or dark-skinned, holding long green sticks, frightened, curious, they stood on tiptoes to make themselves tall enough to see the wounded soldier inside. And when Jean-Marie moved, they disappeared, like frogs jumping into the water. Sometimes the open gate let in a chicken, a ferocious old dog, an enormous turkey. Jean-Marie only saw his hosts at mealtimes. During the day, the old woman in the white hat tended to him. In the evening, two young women would sit with him. One was called Cécile, the other Madeleine. For a long time he thought they were sisters, but no, Cécile was the farmer's daughter, and Madeleine was a foster child. Both of them were attractive, not beautiful, but fresh-faced. Cécile had a round red face and lively brown eyes. Madeleine was more delicate, a blonde with bright cheeks, smooth as satin and pink as apple blossom. From the young women he learned what had happened that week. As they spoke about it in their slightly harsh accent, all those terribly serious events lost their tragic element. "It's really sad," they would say, and "it's not very nice to see things like that." "Oh, monsieur, it's really upsetting." He wondered if all the people here spoke like them, or whether it was something much deeper, rooted in the very souls of these girls, in their youth, some instinct that told them that wars end and invaders leave, that even when distorted, even when mutilated, life goes on. His own mother, knitting while the soup was cooking, would sigh and say, 1914, that's the year your father and I got married. We were miserable by the end of it, but very happy at the beginning. Even that bleak year was sweetened, bathed in the reflection of their love. In the same way, he thought, the summer of 1940 would remain in the memories of these young women as the summer they were 20, in spite of everything. He didn't want to think. Thinking was worse than physical pain. But everything flooded back. Everything went round and round in his head endlessly. Being called back from leave on the 15th of May. Those 4 days in Angers. No trains running anymore, soldiers lying on wooden boards being bitten by insects. Then the air raids, the bombings, the Battle of Rethel, the retreat, the Battle of the Somme, another retreat. Days when they'd fled from city to city without officers, without orders, without weapons. And finally, a train compartment in flames. He tossed and turned, groaning. He didn't know if the fighting was real or if it was all a confusing dream born of his thirst and high fever. Come on, it wasn't possible. There are some things that just aren't possible. Hadn't someone said something about Sedan? That was in 1870. He could picture it still. It was at the top of the page in the history book with a reddish cloth cover. It was, he quietly pronounced the words, Sedan. The defeat at Sedan, the disastrous Battle of Sedan, decided the outcome of the war. On the wall above him, the image on the calendar, the smiling, rosy-cheeked soldier with the two women from Alsace who were showing off their white stockings. Yes, all that was a dream, the past. And he started trembling and said, "Thank you, it's nothing, thank you. Please don't trouble yourself," while they slipped a hot water bottle under his heavy, stiff legs. "You seem better tonight." "I feel better," he replied. He asked for a mirror and smiled when he saw the black beard on his chin. "I have to shave tomorrow." "If you're strong enough. Who do you want to look handsome for?" "For you." They laughed and moved closer. They were curious to know where he came from, where he'd been wounded. Now and again, feeling guilty, they would stop talking. "Oh, but you mustn't let us chatter on. You'll get tired. Then we'll start arguing." "We will." "It's Michaud, your name? Jean-Marie?" "Yes." "Are you from Paris? What do you do? Are you a worker?" "Of course not. I can tell by your hands. You work in business, or maybe in the government?" "Just a student." "Oh, you study. Why?" "My goodness," he said after thinking a moment. I wonder why myself sometimes. It was funny. He and his friends had worked, sat and passed exams, earned diplomas, all the time knowing it was pointless, it wouldn't do them any good because there would be a war. Their future had been mapped out in advance, their careers were made in heaven, just like they used to say that marriages were made in heaven. He'd been conceived while his father was home on leave in 1915. He was born out of the war, and, he had always known it, war would be his fate. There was nothing morbid in this idea. He shared it with many boys his age. It was simply logical and reasonable. But, he said to himself, the worst is over now, and that changes everything. Once again there is a future. The war is over, terrible, shameful, but over. And there is hope. I wanted to write books, he said shyly, expressing to these country girls, these strangers, a wish buried deep in his heart that had barely taken shape in his mind. Then he wanted to know the name of the place, the farm where he was. It's far from everywhere, said Cecile, the middle of nowhere. Oh, it's not usually much fun, I can tell you. The more we look after the animals, the more like them we become, right, Madeleine? Have you been here a long time, Mademoiselle Madeleine? I was 3 weeks old. Cecile's mother brought the two of us up together. We're sisters 'cause we nursed from the same mother. I can see you get along well together. We don't always think alike, said Cecile. She'd like to become a nun. Sometimes, said Madeleine, smiling. She had a pretty smile, unhurried and a little shy. I wonder where she came from, Jean-Marie thought. Her hands were red, but they were graceful, like her ankles and legs. A foster child. He felt a little curious and a bit sorry for her. He was grateful to her for the hazy daydream she inspired in him. They were a diversion. They prevented him from thinking about himself, about the war. It was just a shame he felt so weak. It was difficult to laugh, to joke with them, and that must be what they were hoping for. In the countryside, it was commonplace for young girls and boys to tease each other. It was their custom, it was what they did. They would be disappointed and upset if he didn't laugh with them. He made an effort to smile. A boy will come along who will make you change your mind, Mademoiselle Madeleine. Then you won't want to be a nun any more. It's true. It comes over me sometimes, it does. When? Oh, I don't know. On sad days. As for boys, well, there aren't many round here, said Cecile. I told you, we're in the middle of nowhere. The few that are get taken by the war. So, then what? Oh, it's really bad luck being a girl. Everyone, said Madeleine, has some bad luck. She had sat down next to the wounded young man, but suddenly she got up. Cecile, did you forget? The floor's not been washed. It's your turn. Oh, really? You've got some nerve. It's your turn. They argued for a few minutes, then did the job together. They were amazingly skillful and lively. Soon the cool water made the red flagstone shine. The smell of grass, milk, and wild mint drifted in from the doorway. Jean-Marie rested his cheek on his hand. It was strange, the contrast between this absolute serenity and the turmoil within him. For the unbearable din of the last 6 days had remained in his ears, and it only took a moment of silence for it all to rise up again. The sound of twisting metal, the dull, slow beating of an iron hammer on an enormous anvil. He winced and started sweating all over. Train compartments being machine-gunned, the crash of collapsing beams drowning out people's screams. Even so, he said out loud, I just have to put that out of my mind, don't I? What's that? Do you need something? He didn't reply. Suddenly he didn't recognize Cecile and Madeleine. They shook their heads, dismayed. It's his fever getting worse. And you made him talk too much. Are you having me on? He didn't say a word. We were the ones talking the whole time. It wore him out. Madeleine leaned down over him. He saw her pink cheek right next to his, caught its scent of strawberries, and kissed it. She stood back, blushing and laughing, fixing some locks of hair that had fallen down. all right now. You've scared me. You're not as sick as all that. Who on earth is this girl? He thought. He had kissed her as if he were bringing a glass of cool water to his lips. He was on fire. His throat, the inside of his mouth, seemed to crack from the heat, dried out by the intensity of the flames. This bright, soft skin quenched his thirst. At the same time, he felt totally lucid, with the kind of lucidity that comes from sleeplessness and fever. He'd forgotten the names of these young girls and his own, the mental effort it took to understand his present condition in this place he didn't recognize was too difficult for him. He wore himself out trying. But in the meantime, his soul drifted light and serene like a fish in the water, like a bird blown along by the wind. He didn't see himself, Jean-Marie, but someone else. A nameless soldier, defeated but refusing to give up hope, a wounded young man who did not want to die, a desperate man who refused to despair. Even so, we have to make it through. We have to get away from this blood, from this mud dragging us down. We're not just going to lie down and die, are we? Well, are we? That would be too ridiculous. We have to hang on, hang on, hang on, he muttered. And when he came to, eyes wide open, clinging to his bolster, sitting up in bed, he gazed at the night with its full moon, a silent, sweet-smelling night, a sparkling night, so gentle after the heat of the day, and which, for once, the farmhouse welcomed through its open doors and windows, so it could refresh and bring peace to the suffering man. Chapter 25. When Father Perican found himself forced to continue the journey on foot, the boys following after him, each carrying a blanket and haversack and dragging their feet in the dust, he had decided to head away from the Loire, an area fraught with danger, towards the woods. But soldiers had already set up camp there, and since planes were bound to spot them from the air, the danger seemed just as great amid the trees as on the river banks. And so, leaving the main road, he took a path covered with stones, virtually a footpath, trusting his instinct to lead him to some isolated house, just as when, in the mountains, he led his group of skiers towards a refuge hidden by the fog or snowstorm. It was a beautiful June day, so brilliant and hot that the boys felt intoxicated. Silent until now, and well-behaved, too well-behaved, they began jostling each other, shouting, and Father Perican could hear laughter and snatches of whispered songs. He listened more closely, and hearing an obscene refrain mumbled behind him as if through half-closed lips, he suggested they all sing a song together. He struck up, energetically enunciating the words, but only a few voices joined in. After some moments, everyone fell silent. He too walked on without speaking, wondering what this sudden freedom might awaken within these poor children. What disturbing desires, what dreams. One of the younger ones stopped suddenly and cried, "A lizard! Oh, a lizard, look!" In the sunshine between two rocks, agile tails appeared, disappeared. They could see their delicate flat heads, their throats pulsating in and out to a rapid, frightened beat. The boys watched, entranced. Some of them even knelt down on the path. The priest waited a few moments, then waved to them to move on. The children meekly got up. But at that very moment, pebbles flew out of their hands with such dexterity, such surprising speed, that two of the lizards, the most beautiful, the biggest, their skin a delicate blue-grey colour, were killed on the spot. "Why did you do that?" the priest exclaimed, upset. No one replied. "Well, why? What a spineless act!" "But they're like snakes. They bite," said a boy with a long pointed nose and a pale, dazed expression. "Don't be ridiculous. Lizards are harmless." "Oh, we didn't know, Father," he replied in a sly voice, with a feigned innocence that didn't fool the priest. But he knew it was neither the time nor the place to insist. He just nodded briefly as if he were satisfied with the answer and added, "Well, now you know." He organized them into lines to follow him. Until now he'd let them walk as they liked, but he suddenly thought that some of them might try to run away. They obeyed him so perfectly, so mechanically. no doubt used to hearing the whistle blow, to standing in line, to being docile, to enforced silence, but it broke his heart. He glanced at their faces, which had suddenly become glum and lifeless, as closed as a house when the door is locked, the life within withdrawn, absent, or dead. "We'd better hurry up if we want to find shelter tonight," he said. "As soon as I know where we'll be sleeping, and after we eat, you'll be getting hungry soon, we can make a campfire, and you can stay outdoors as long as you like." He walked among them, talked to them about his young boys from the Auvergne, about skiing, mountain climbing, trying to interest them, to get closer to them. All in vain. They didn't even seem to be listening. He realized that anything he said to them, encouragement, reprimands, information, would never sink in, for their souls were shut off, walled up, secret and silent. "If only I could look after them for longer," he thought to himself. But in his heart, he knew he didn't really want to. He only wanted one thing, to be rid of them as soon as possible, to be relieved of his responsibility, and this feeling of unease he felt weighing down on him. The duty of love, which until now he'd felt was almost simple, so great was the grace of God within him, now seemed almost impossible to feel. Even though, he thought humbly, it would mean that for the first time, perhaps, I would really have to try. It would be a true sacrifice. How weak I am. He called over one of the younger boys, who was always lagging behind. "Are you tired? Do your shoes hurt?" Yes, he'd guessed correctly. The lad's shoes were too tight and hurting him. He took his hand to help him, talking to him quietly. And since the boy was slouching, his shoulders stooped, his back round, the priest gently placed two fingers round his neck and pulled him up straight. The young boy didn't resist. In fact, with a distant, indifferent look on his face, he leaned his neck against the hand that held it. And this light, insistent pressure, this strange, ambiguous caress, or rather this expectation of a caress, made the priest blush. He took the child by the chin and tried to look into his eyes, but his eyelids were lowered, and he couldn't see into them. He walked faster, trying to collect himself with an internal dialogue, as he always did at sad moments. It wasn't exactly what you'd call a prayer. Often it wasn't even a collection of words recognizable as human speech. It was a kind of intangible meditation from which he emerged, bathed in joy and peace. But both abandoned him today. The pity he felt was corrupted by a stirring of anxiety and bitterness. It was only too clear that these poor wretches were lacking grace, his grace. He wanted to be able to shower them with grace, inundate their barren hearts with love and faith. It would take but a sigh from our crucified Lord, the flutter of a wing from one of his angels to bring about the miracle. But nevertheless, he, Philippe Perricon, had been chosen by God to soften them, to unlock their souls, to prepare them to receive God. He suffered because he was incapable of bringing it about. He had been spared the moments of doubt and the sudden hardening of the soul that take hold of some believers, abandoning them not in the hands of the princes of this world, but in a terrible darkness halfway between Satan and God. His temptation was different. It was a kind of impatience to be holy, the desire to gather liberated souls around him, a ripple of urgency which, once he'd opened someone's heart to God, propelled him towards other conquests, leaving him forever frustrated, dissatisfied, disappointed with himself. It wasn't enough. No, Lord Jesus, it wasn't enough. The old heathen who had confessed, taken communion in his final hour, the sinful woman who had renounced vice, the pagan who had wanted to be baptized, not enough. No, not enough. He recognized something similar in the way a greedy man hoards his gold. And yet, no, it wasn't exactly like that. It reminded him of certain moments he'd spent at the river when he was a child. The quiver of joy every time he caught a fish. Yet now he didn't understand how he could have liked such a cruel game, and even found it difficult to eat fish. Vegetables, dairy products, fresh bread, chestnuts, and that country soup so thick the spoon stands straight up in it, all by itself, these were all he needed to sustain him. But as a child he'd been fanatical about fishing. and he remembered his anguish when the sun began to set on the water, when he had hardly caught any fish and he knew the day was nearly over. He'd been criticised for his excessive scruples. He himself feared they might not come from God, but from an other. Yet never had he felt that anguish as he did today, on this journey beneath this sky, where lethal planes sparkled, among these children whose physical bodies were the only thing he could hope to save. They'd been walking for some time when they saw the first houses of a village. It was very small, intact, empty. Its inhabitants had fled. However, before leaving, they had firmly secured the doors and windows. They'd taken their dogs with them, carried the rabbits and chickens. Only a few cats were left behind, sleeping in the sunshine on garden paths or walking along the low roofs, looking replete and tranquil. It was the time of year when all the roses were in bloom. So above every doorway, beautiful flowers opened their petals, generously, happily inviting the wasps and bumblebees to drink from deep inside their hearts. This village, abandoned by its people, where no footsteps, no voices could be heard, and where all the sounds of the countryside were absent, the creaking of wheelbarrows, the cooing of pigeons, the clucking from the poultry yards, this village had become the kingdom of the birds, the bees, and the hornets. Philippe thought he had never heard so many vibrant, joyous songs, nor seen so many swarms all around him. Hay, strawberries, blackcurrants, the little sweet-smelling flowers in the borders, each flower bed, each lawn, each blade of grass gave off a soft, buzzing sound like a spinning wheel. All these small plots had been tended with loving care. All of them had an archway covered with roses, a tunnel where you could still see the last lilacs of the season, two iron chairs, a bench in the sunshine. The red currants were enormous, transparent and golden. "What a wonderful dessert they will make for us tonight," said Philippe. "The birds will have to share with us. We won't be harming anyone by picking this fruit. Now, you all have plenty of food in your backpacks, so we won't go hungry, but don't expect to be sleeping in a bed tonight. I don't suppose sleeping under the stars for one night would frighten you, would it? You have good blankets. Let's see, what do we need? A meadow, a natural spring. The barns and stables don't appeal to you, I bet. Me neither. It's so beautiful out. Come on, eat some fruit to keep you going and follow me. We'll try and find a good spot." He waited a quarter of an hour while the children gorged themselves on strawberries. He watched them carefully to make sure they didn't step on the flowers and vegetables, but he didn't have to intervene. They were really very good. He didn't blow the whistle this time, just spoke loudly. "Come on now, leave some for tonight. Follow me. If you don't dawdle, you won't have to line up." Once again they obeyed. They looked at the trees, the sky, the flowers, without Philippe being able to guess what they were actually thinking. What they really liked, he thought, what really touched their hearts, was not the natural world, but this intoxicating scent of fresh air and freedom they were breathing in, so new to them. "Do any of you know the countryside?" Philippe asked. "No, father, no, sir, no," they all said, one after the other. Philippe had already noticed that he would only get a response from them after a few moments' silence, as if they were making up a story, a lie, or as if they didn't exactly understand what they were meant to do. Always the same feeling of dealing with people who were not quite human, he thought. Out loud, he said, "Come on, let's get moving." When they left the village, they saw a large, overgrown private park, a beautifully deep, clear lake, and a house up on a hill. "The chateau, without doubt," thought Philippe. He rang the bell at the gate in the hope of finding someone at home, but the caretaker's cottage was locked up and no one answered. "There's a meadow over there, and that looks perfect for us," said Philippe, pointing towards the banks of the lake. "We must make the best of it, boys. We'll cause less damage there than in these beautiful little gardens. We'll be better off than on the road, and if there's a storm, we could take shelter in those little changing huts." The park had only a wire fence round it. They got over it easily. "Don't forget," Philippe said, laughing, "that even though I'm breaking a rule, I still insist you treat this property with the utmost respect. I don't want to see a single branch broken, papers left on the lawn, or any empty tins, understand? If you behave, then I'll let you go swimming in the lake tomorrow." The grass was so high it came up to their knees, and they crushed flowers underfoot. Philippe showed them the flowers associated with the Virgin, stars with six white petals, and St. Joseph's flowers, pale lilac, almost pink.
"Can we pick them, sir?"
"Yes, you can pick as many of those as you like. They just need a bit of sun and rain to grow back again. Now, those must have taken a lot of time and effort," he said, pointing to the flower beds planted all around the chateau.
One of the boys next to him raised his small square face towards the large shuttered windows.
"Must be some great stuff in there."
He'd spoken quietly, but with such muted envy that the priest was troubled. When he didn't reply, the boy persisted,
"Don't you think, Father, there must be some great stuff in there?"
"We ain't never seen a place like that," said another.
"Of course there must be some very beautiful things inside, furniture, paintings, statues. But many of these houses are just ruins, and you would probably be disappointed if you expected to see amazing things," Philippe replied cheerfully.
"But I suppose you're most interested in the food. I should tell you that the people from around here seem to have planned ahead and taken everything away with them. And since we wouldn't have the right to help ourselves to anything that didn't belong to us in any case, it's better not to think about it and just make do with what we have. Now I'm going to put you into three groups. The first will find some dead wood, the second will get some water, the third will lay out the food."
They followed his orders, working quickly and efficiently. They lit a big fire at the edge of the lake. They ate, they drank, they picked some wild strawberries. Philippe wanted to organise some games, but the children seemed gloomy and restrained. There was no shouting, no laughter. The lake no longer shone in the sunlight, just faintly glimmered, and they could hear frogs croaking on the banks. In the light of the fire, the boys sat motionless, wrapped up in their blankets.
"Do you want to go to sleep?"
No one answered.
"You aren't cold, are you?"
Silence again. "They can't all be asleep," thought the priest. He got up and walked between the rows. Sometimes he bent down, covered someone up who was thinner, frailer than the others, with limp hair, ears that stuck out. Their eyes were closed. They were pretending to be asleep, or perhaps sleep really had overcome them. Philippe went back to read his Bible next to the fire. Now and again he raised his eyes to look at the reflections in the water. These moments of silent meditation took away all his cares, made up for all his pain. Once again, love entered his heart, like rain falling on dry ground, first drop by drop, fighting to carve a path through the pebbles, then in a long cascade straight to his heart. These poor children. One of them was dreaming and letting out a long, plaintive moan. The priest raised his hand in the darkness, blessed them, murmured a prayer. "Pater amat vos," he whispered. He liked to say this to his catechism students when he was urging them to repent, to be submissive, to pray. "The Father loves you." How could he have believed they were lacking divine grace, these poor wretches? Might he not perhaps be less loved than them, treated with less indulgence, less divine affection than the most insignificant, the most lowly of them? "Oh, Lord Jesus, forgive me." It was a moment of pride, a trap set by a demon. "What am I? Less than nothing, dust beneath your dear feet, Lord. Yes, without a doubt, I, whom you have loved, whom you have protected since I was a child, whom you have led towards you, you have the right to ask anything of me. But these children, some will be saved, the others, the saints will redeem them. Yes, all is well. All is goodness, all is grace. Lord Jesus, forgive me my sorrow." The water gently rippled. The night was peaceful and solemn. This presence without whom he could not live, this breath, this watchful eye was upon him in the darkness. A child sleeping in the dark, pressed against his mother's heart, has no need of light to recognize her cherished features, her hands, her rings. He even laughed softly with pleasure. "Jesus, you are here, with me once again. Please remain by my side, my cherished friend." A long pink flame shot up from a black log. It was late. The moon was rising, but he wasn't tired.
He took a blanket, stretched out on the grass. There he remained, eyes wide open, a flower brushing lightly against his cheek. There wasn't a single sound in this little corner of the world. He heard nothing, saw nothing, but felt by a kind of sixth sense two boys silently rushing towards the chateau. It happened so quickly that at first he thought he was dreaming. He didn't want to call out for fear of waking the other sleeping boys. He got up, brushed the grass and flowers off his cassock and headed for the chateau. The thick lawn hid the sound of his footsteps. He remembered now he'd noticed one of the shutters had been badly secured and was slightly ajar. Yes, he was right. The moon lit up the front of the house. One of the boys was pushing the shutter, forcing it open. Before Philippe could shout at them to stop, a stone shattered the window and there was a rain of glass. The boys, as lithe as cats, leapt inside. "Oh, you little brats, just wait till I sort you out," Philippe said to himself. Hoisting up his cassock, he followed them through the window and found himself in a drawing room with furniture covered with dust sheets and a large, cold parquet floor. He groped about in the dark for a few moments before finding the light switch. When he turned the lights on, he saw no one. He hesitated, looked around. The boys were hiding or had run off. The sofas, the piano, the winged bergère chairs covered by billowing sheets, the flowered chintz curtains at the windows all made good hiding places. Seeing some fabric move, he walked towards a bay window and yanked back the curtains. One of the boys was there. He was among the oldest, almost an adult, with a blackish face, rather beautiful eyes, a low forehead and a strong jaw. "What are you doing here?" said the priest. He heard a noise behind him and turned round. Another boy was in the room, standing right behind him. He, too, was about 17 or 18. He had thin, contemptuous lips, and his yellowish face looked wild as if he were possessed. Philippe was on his guard, but they were too fast for him. In a flash, they attacked. One tripped him and knocked him down, the other grabbed his throat. But he managed to fight them off silently, successfully. Catching hold of one of them by the collar, he tightened his grip so much that the boy was forced to let go. As the boy pulled away, something fell out of his pocket and rolled along the ground. It was some silver. "Congratulations, you've moved fast," said Philippe, half choking, sitting on the floor, thinking to himself, "The main thing is not to make a big thing of it. Just get them out of here and they'll follow me like little puppies. Then we'll sort it out tomorrow." "That's enough now. Enough of this nonsense. Get going." He'd barely finished speaking when once again they threw themselves on him, silently, desperately, savagely. One of them bit him, drew blood. "They're going to kill me," Philippe thought in amazement. They hung on to him like wolves. He didn't want to hurt them, but he was forced to defend himself. They punched him, kicked him. He fought them off, and they came back at him even more violently than before. They no longer looked human. They were demented. Animals. Philippe would have proven the stronger, in spite of everything. But they hit him on the head with a pedestal table with bronze legs. He fell down, and as he fell, he heard one of the boys run to the window and whistle. He saw nothing else. Not the 28 teenagers suddenly waking up, running across the lawn, climbing through the window. Not the rush towards the delicate furniture that was being ripped apart and thrown out onto the grass. They were frenzied. They danced around the priest as he lay sprawled on the floor. They sang and shouted. One of the youngest, with a girlish face, jumped with both feet onto a sofa whose old springs creaked under the weight. The older ones had discovered a liquor cabinet. They dragged it into the drawing room, kicking it to move it along. When they opened it, they saw it was empty, but they didn't need liquor to be drunk. The carnage was enough for them. They felt a terrifying kind of joy. Dragging Philippe by the feet, they threw him out of the window so he fell heavily onto the lawn. At the edge of the lake, they swung him like a bundle. "Heave ho! Kill him!" they shouted in their harsh, high-pitched voices, some of which still sounded childlike. When Philippe fell into the water, he was still alive. Out of a sense of self-preservation or a final burst of courage, he managed to remain at the edge of the lake. He clutched the branch of a tree with both hands and tried hard to keep his head above water. His battered face was red, swollen and grotesque. They were throwing stones at him. He held on at first, clinging with all his might to the branch that was swaying, cracking, giving way. He tried to get to the other shore, but he was being bombarded. Finally, he raised both arms, put them in front of his face, and the boys saw him sink straight down in his black cassock. He hadn't drowned. He'd got trapped in the mud. And that was how he died, in water up to his waist, head thrown back, one eye gouged out by a stone.
Chapter 26. At the Cathedral of Notre-Dame in Nîmes, a mass was celebrated every year for the members of the Perican-Maltet family who had passed on. Since only Madame Perican's mother lived in Nîmes, this service was usually a brief affair in one of the side chapels, attended by the elderly lady herself, half-blind and obese, whose heavy breathing drowned out the priest's voice, and a cook who had worked for the household for 30 years. Madame Perican had been born a Craquant, related to the Marseille branch of the Craquant family, who had made their money in olive oil. This ancestry seemed extremely respectable to her, of course, and her dowry had been 2 million at its pre-war value, but it paled in comparison with that of her new relations. Her mother, the elder Madame Craquant, agreed with this view of things, and having gone to live alone in Nîmes, she observed all the Perican rituals with great fidelity, praying for the dead and sending letters of congratulations to the living on the occasion of marriages and baptisms, just as the colonial English raised solitary glasses on the day London was celebrating the Queen's birthday. This mass for the deceased was particularly agreeable to Madame Craquant, because she would stop at a tea-room on her way home from the cathedral and have a cup of hot chocolate and 2 croissants. As she was extremely fat, her doctor made her follow a strict diet, but her early morning rise and the lengthy and, to her, very tiring walk from the great carved door of the cathedral to her pew allowed her to devour these fortifying foods without remorse. Sometimes, when her cook, of whom she lived in fear, had her back turned and was standing rigid and silent near the door of the tea-room, their 2 prayer books in her hand, Madame Craquant's black shawl over her arm, she would even draw a platter of little cakes towards her, and with affected nonchalance pop a cream-filled choux bun into her mouth, or a cherry tart, or both. Outside, her carriage, drawn by 2 old horses and driven by a coachman almost as fat as Madame Craquant herself, waited, flies buzzing around in the heat. This year, everything was at 6s and 7s. The Pericans, who had fled to Nîmes after the events of June, had just learned of the deaths of the old Monsieur Perican Maltet and Philippe. News of the first had been conveyed by the sisters in the nursing home, where the old gentleman had had, according to Sister Marie of the Sacred Sacrament's letter, a good death, very comforting, very Christian. She'd even been so kind as to describe in the most minute detail the contents of his last will and testament, which would be written up as soon as possible. Madame Perican read and reread the final sentence of the letter, and sighed, a look of anxiety spreading across her face, only to be replaced, a moment later, with the expression of contrition a good Christian feels when she learns that someone she loves has gone to find peace with the good Lord. "Your grandfather is with Jesus, children," she said. 2 hours later, the second blow to strike the family was revealed, but in less detail. The mayor of a little village in the Loiret informed them that Father Philippe Perican had been killed in an accident, and sent them papers that confirmed his identity beyond a doubt. As for the 30 wards in his care, they had disappeared. Since half of France was looking for the other half, this surprised no one. There was mention of a truck which had fallen in the river not far from where Philippe had met his death, and his relations remained convinced that this had something to do with him and his unfortunate orphans. To cap it all, Madame Perican was told that Hubert had been killed at the Battle of Moulins. This time the catastrophe was complete. The intensity of her sorrow caused her to cry out in proud despair.
"I gave birth to a saint and a hero," she said. "Our sons are making sacrifices for other people's sons." And she looked darkly at her cousin, Craquant, whose only child had managed to get a peaceful little post in the Home Guard in Toulouse. "Dear Odette, my heart is breaking. You know that I lived only for my children, that I was a mother, nothing but a mother."
Madame Craquant, who had been a trifle frivolous in her youth, lowered her head.
"But I swear to you, the pride I feel makes me forget my bereavement."
She drew herself up, and, already imagining the black veil fluttering around her, showed her cousin to the door with pride and dignity.
"You are a true Catholic," Odette sighed humbly. Just a good Frenchwoman, Madame Péricombe replied dryly, turning her back. This conversation had lessened her sorrow slightly. She'd always respected Philippe, and in some way understood he was not of this world. She knew that if he had renounced his dream of being a missionary, it was out of humility, and that he had chosen to serve God in the way that was the most difficult for him, by subjecting himself to the most commonplace duties. She was certain her son was with Jesus. When she said the same thing about her father-in-law, it was with a secret doubt for which she reproached herself, but there it was. But Philippe, I can see him as if I were there, she thought. Yes, she could be proud of Philippe, and the radiance of his soul reflected back onto her. Whereas, when she thought of Hubert, she felt a strange turmoil. Hubert, who failed miserably at school, who bit his nails, Hubert with his ink-stained fingers, his lovely chubby face, his wide young mouth. For Hubert to die a hero was inconceivable. When she talked to her sympathetic friends about how Hubert had left, I tried to stop him, but I saw how impossible it was. He was a child, but a courageous child, and he has given his life for the honour of France. As Rostand said, it is even more beautiful because it is pointless. She found that she was rewriting the past. She actually believed she'd said all these proud words, that she had sent her son off to war. Nîmes, which had looked upon her until now rather bitterly, felt a respect for this sorrowful mother that was almost affectionate.
"The whole town will be there today," old Madame Craquant sighed with melancholy satisfaction.
It was the 31st of July. Their Mass for the Dead was due to be celebrated at 10 o'clock, with three names tragically added.
"Oh, Mother, what does it matter?"
replied Madame Péricombe, and it was impossible to tell if she was referring to the uselessness of such consolation or to the very poor opinion she had of her fellow citizens. The town gleamed beneath the blazing sun. In the poorer districts, a dry and insidious wind rattled the bead curtains in doorways. The flies bit. You could smell a storm coming. Nîmes, normally sleepy at this time of year, was crowded with people. The refugees who had poured in were still there, unable to leave because of petrol shortages and the temporary closure of the border along the Loire. The streets and town squares had been transformed into parking lots. There was not a spare room anywhere. People had been sleeping in the streets. The ultimate luxury was a bale of hay to use as a bed. The citizens of Nîmes were proud of themselves for having done their duty and more towards the refugees. They had welcomed them with open arms, pressed them against their bosoms. There was not a single family who had not offered hospitality to these poor people. It was just a shame that this state of affairs was dragging on so unreasonably long. It was also the matter of provisions, and you can't forget either, said the townspeople, that all these poor refugees, exhausted by their journey, would be susceptible to the most terrible epidemics. There were veiled hints in the press, and more open, brutal demands from other quarters, urging the refugees to leave as soon as possible. But, as yet, circumstances had prevented anyone from going anywhere. Madame Craquant, who had her entire family living with her, and was therefore able, head held high, to refuse to donate even a pair of sheets, rather enjoyed all this hustle and bustle, which she witnessed through her half-closed Venetian blinds. She was having her breakfast, along with the Péricombe children, before going to church. Madame Péricombe watched them eat. She did not touch her own food, even though, thanks to the stock of supplies accumulated in her mother's enormous cupboard since war had been declared, it was more appetizing than the usual rations. Madame Craquant was troubled by her daughter's cold stare. A snow-white napkin covering her vast chest, she was polishing off her third piece of buttered toast when she felt a touch of indigestion. She put the toast down and looked at her daughter timidly.
"I don't know why I'm eating, Charlotte," she said. "It's not going down well."
"You'll have to force yourself, Mother,"
replied Madame Péricombe ironically, her voice as cold as ice, and she pushed the full jug of hot chocolate towards the old lady.
"All right, then. Pour me another half cup, Charlotte, but not more than half a cup now."
"You know it's your third."
But Madame Craquant seemed suddenly struck deaf.
"Yes, yes," she said vaguely, nodding her head.
You're right, Charlotte. We must fortify ourselves before the sad ceremony.
And she drank up the frothy chocolate with a sigh. Meanwhile, the doorbell rang and one of the servants brought in a package for Madame Perricon. It contained photographs of Philippe and Hubert. She'd sent them to be framed. She looked at them for a long time, then got up, put them down on the sideboard, stood back to see how they looked, went into her bedroom, and came back carrying two black rosettas and two red, white and blue ribbons. As she draped them over the picture frames, they heard Nanny sobbing in the doorway, Emmanuel in her arms. Jacqueline and Bernard also started crying. Madame Perricon took the children by the hand, gently pulled them from their chairs and walked them over to the sideboard.
Just look at your two big brothers, my darlings. Ask the good Lord to bless you, so you might be like them. Try to be as good, as studious and obedient as they were. They were such good sons, said Madame Perricon, her voice choking with pain. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if God has rewarded them by recognizing them as martyrs. You mustn't cry. They are with the good Lord. They are looking down on us, protecting us. They will be waiting for us in heaven. And in the meantime, here on earth, we must be proud of them, both as Christians and as citizens of France.
Everyone was crying now. Even Madame Craquant had stopped drinking her hot chocolate and was looking for her handkerchief, her hands trembling. The photograph of Philippe was amazingly lifelike. It really captured his pure, intense expression, and he seemed to contemplate his family with that smile of his that was sweet, kind and loving.
And when you say your prayers, you mustn't forget, Madame Perricon concluded, those unfortunate children who died with him.
But maybe they aren't all dead.
It's possible, Madame Perricon said vaguely. Very possible. Those poor children. On the other hand, she added, that charitable institution really is a great responsibility.
And her thoughts ran back to her father-in-law's will.
Madame Craquan dried her eyes. Little Hubert, he was so sweet, so funny. I remember one day when you were visiting, I'd fallen asleep in the sitting room after lunch. That naughty boy goes and takes down the flypaper from the chandelier and quietly lowers it onto my head. I woke up and screamed. You certainly punished him that day, Charlotte.
I don't remember, said Charlotte dryly. Now come on, Mother, finish your hot chocolate. We have to hurry. The carriage is downstairs. It's nearly 10 o'clock. They went into the street, the grandmother first, puffing and leaning on her cane, then Madame Perricon, swathed in black crepe, followed by her two children in black, Emmanuel in white, and a few of the servants, all in full mourning attire. The carriage was waiting. The driver was getting down from his seat to open the door, when suddenly Emmanuel pointed a little finger towards the crowd.
Hubert! Look! It's Hubert!
Turning automatically to look, Nanny blanched and let out a strangled cry.
Jesus, blessed Virgin Mary!
A sort of hoarse howl came from the mouth of Madame Perricon. She threw back her black veil, took a few steps towards Hubert, then slipped on the pavement and collapsed into the arms of the driver, who had rushed forward just in time to catch her. It really was Hubert. A lock of hair in his eyes, skin as pink and golden as a nectarine, with no bags, no bicycle, no wounds, walking towards them with a huge grin on his face.
Hello, Mother. Hello, Grandmother. How is everyone?
Is it you? Is it you? You're alive,
said Madame Craquant, laughing and crying at the same time.
Oh, my darling Hubert, I knew you couldn't really be dead. Dear God, you're too mischievous for that.
Madame Perricon came round.
Hubert, is it really you?
She stammered weakly. Hubert was both pleased and embarrassed by this welcome. He took a few steps towards his mother and leaned over so she could kiss his cheeks, which she did, not knowing exactly what she was doing.
Then he stood in front of her, shifting from one foot to the other, just as he did when he failed Latin translation at school.
"Hubert,"
she sighed, and threw her arms round his neck, hanging on to him, showering him with kisses and tears. An emotional little crowd had gathered around them. Hubert, who had no idea what to do, patted Madame Perricon's back, as if something had gone down the wrong way.
"Weren't you expecting me?"
She shook her head.
"Were you going out?" "My poor boy, we were going to the cathedral to say a mass for your soul."
Hubert was taken aback.
"You're joking. But where have you been? What have you been doing these past 2 months? We were told you'd been killed in Moulins."
"Well, you can see that wasn't true, since I'm right here."
"But you did go and fight."
"Hubert, don't lie to me. Did you really have to go and do that, you little idiot? And what about your bicycle? Where's your bicycle?"
"Lost."
"Of course. This boy will be the death of me. Well, come on, speak. Tell us, where were you?"
"I was trying to find you."
"You would have been better off not leaving us in the first place," said Madame Perricon harshly. Then, her voice breaking with emotion,
"Your father will be so happy when he hears."
She burst into tears and started kissing him again. It was getting late now, but even though she wiped her eyes, the tears kept falling.
"Go on, then, go inside and get washed. Are you hungry?"
"No, I had a good lunch, thanks."
"Get a clean handkerchief, change your tie, wash your hands, make yourself decent, for goodness sake. Hurry up and meet us at the cathedral."
"What? You're still going? Since I'm alive, wouldn't it be better to go and stuff ourselves at a restaurant instead?"
"Hubert!"
"What? Is it because I said stuff ourselves?"
"No, but..."
It would be terrible to tell him, like this, in the middle of the street, she thought. She took his hand and pulled him inside the carriage. "My darling, there have been two great tragedies. First, Grandpa, poor Grandpa, died. And Philippe."
He took the shock in an odd way. 2 months earlier, he would have burst into tears, big, fat, salty tears rolling down his pink cheeks. Now he went very pale, and his face took on an expression she had never seen before, manly, almost harsh.
"I don't much mind about Grandpa," he said after a long silence. "As for Philippe..."
"Hubert, are you mad?"
"No, I don't much mind, and neither do you. He was old and ill. What would he have done in all this chaos?"
"Well, really,"
Madame Craquant protested. But he ignored her and continued talking to his mother.
"As for Philippe..." "But first, are you really sure? It couldn't be like what happened with me."
"We are sure, I'm afraid. Philippe..."
His voice trembled and broke.
"He wasn't of this world. Other people talk about heaven all the time, but they only think about this world. Philippe, he came from God, and he must be very happy now."
He hid his face in his hands and remained motionless for a long time. Then they heard the cathedral bells ringing. Madame Perricon touched her son's arm. "Shall we go?" He nodded. They all got into the carriage, the servants following in another, and made their way to the cathedral. Hubert walked between his mother and grandmother. They remained on either side of him as he knelt on his prayer cushion. He'd been recognised. He could hear whispering, muffled cries. Madame Craquant had not been wrong. The whole town was there. Everyone had a good view of the survivor who had come to give thanks to God for his deliverance on the very day his family had gathered to pray for their dead. On the whole, everyone was happy. The fact that a good lad like Hubert had managed to avoid German bullets flattered their sense of justice and their craving for miracles. All the mothers who had had no news since May, and there were so many of them, felt hope beat within their breast, and it was impossible to feel resentful about it, as they might have been tempted to do, some people have all the luck, when sadly poor Philippe, an excellent priest, absolutely everyone said so, had died. And so, despite the solemnity of the surroundings, many women smiled at Hubert. He didn't see them. His mother's words had thrust him into a state of profound shock, from which he still hadn't emerged. Philippe's death was tearing him apart.
He had returned to that terrible state of mind he felt when France was falling, before the desperate and vain battle of Moulins. If we were all the same, he thought, looking over the congregation, if we were all pigs and dogs, then it might be understandable. But saints like Philippe, why are they sent here? If it's to save us, to make up for our sins, it's like offering a pearl in exchange for a bag of stones. The people around him, his family, his friends, aroused a feeling of shame and rage within him. He'd seen them on the road, them and people like them. He recalled the cars full of officers running away with their beautiful yellow trunks and their painted women, civil servants abandoning their posts, panic-stricken politicians dropping files of secret papers along the road, young girls who had diligently wept the day the armistice was signed, being comforted in the arms of the Germans. And to think that no one will know, that there will be such a conspiracy of lies that all this will be transformed into yet another glorious page in the history of France. We'll do everything we can to find acts of devotion and heroism for the official records. Good God, to see what I've seen. Closed doors where you knock in vain to get a glass of water, and refugees who pillaged houses everywhere, everywhere you look. Chaos, cowardice, vanity and ignorance. What a wonderful race we are. Meanwhile, he was absently following the service, his heart so heavy and hard that it caused him physical pain. Several times he sighed gruffly, which worried his mother. She turned towards him, her eyes shining with tears through her black veil. "Are you in pain?" she whispered. "No, mother," he replied, looking at her so coldly that he reproached himself for it, but he couldn't help it. He judged his family with bitterness and a painful harshness. His grievances whirled around in his mind in the form of brief, violent images, without him being able to express them clearly, his father calling the Republic this decaying regime, but that same evening 24 places set for dinner at their apartment, with their most beautiful tablecloths, wonderful foie gras and expensive wines, all in honour of a former minister who might be re-elected and might therefore be useful to Monsieur Perricon. God, his mother's tight little mouth saying, "Oh, my dear minister!" Their cars full to bursting with fine linen and silver, caught up among the refugees, and his mother, pointing to women and children forced to walk with just a few bits of clothing wrapped up in a piece of cloth, saying, "Do you see how good our Lord Jesus is? Just think, we could be those unfortunate wretches. Hypocrites, frauds." And what about him? What was he doing here? His heart full of disgust and hatred, he was just pretending to pray for Philippe. But Philippe was... "My God, Philippe, my beloved brother!" He whispered these words, and, as if they had some divine power to console, his painful heart relented. Warm tears flooded down his cheeks. Thoughts of kindness, forgiveness, ran through him. They did not come from within him, but from beyond, as if some friend had leaned down to whisper in his ear, "A family that produced Philippe can't be all bad. You're being too harsh. You've only seen things from the outside. You can't look into their souls. Evil is visible. It burns. It smugly displays itself for all to see. There is only one who can count the sacrifices, who can measure all the blood and tears." He looked at the marble plaque engraved with the names of those who had died in the war, the last war. Among them were some Craquans and Perricons, uncles, cousins he'd never known, children barely older than him, killed at the Somme, Flanders, Verdun, killed twice, since they had died in vain. Little by little, out of this chaos of contradictory feelings, was born a strange, bitter feeling of peace. He had gained valuable experience, knowledge, no longer in an abstract, bookish way, but in his heart, which had beat so wildly, in his hands, which had been torn to shreds trying to defend the bridge at Moulins, in his lips, which had kissed a woman while the Germans celebrated their victory, danger, courage, fear, love. Now he knew the real meaning of these words. Yes, even love. He felt better now, stronger, and very confident. He would never see the world through anyone else's eyes again. But more than that, anything he might love and believe from now on would come from himself and no one else. Slowly he put his hands together, lowered his head, and finally prayed. The mass was over. Outside the cathedral he was surrounded by people wanting to kiss him and congratulate his mother. "And he still has those lovely cheeks," the women all said. "After all he's been through, he's hardly lost any weight. He hasn't changed at all. Dear little Hubert."
Chapter 27. Gabrielle Cotte and Florence arrived at the Grand Hotel at 7 o'clock in the morning. Collapsing with exhaustion, they looked around fearfully, as if they expected, once through the revolving doors, to plunge back into the nightmare of an incoherent world, with refugees sleeping on the cream carpets of the writing room, a hotel manager who didn't recognize them and refused to give them a room, no hot water for a bath, and bombs falling in the lobby. But, thank God, this queen of French spas had remained intact, and the feverish, noisy activity at the lake was simply the way it always was. All the staff were in place. Despite the manager's insistence that they were short of everything, the coffee was delicious, the cocktails were mixed with crushed ice, and the taps poured out as much water as you liked, cold and boiling hot. At first, everyone had been worried. The unfriendly attitude of England made them fear that the blockade would remain in place, thus depriving them of fresh supplies of whisky. But they had a large quantity in stock. They could wait. As soon as they set foot on the marble floor of the lobby, Gabrielle and Florence felt they had been reborn. Everything was calm. You could barely hear the distant whirring of the great lifts. Through the open bay windows, misty, shimmering rainbows created by the hotel's water sprinklers hovered over the lawns. They were recognized and surrounded. The manager of the Grand Hotel, where they had stayed every year for 20 years, raised his arms to heaven and told them it was all over. They had glimpsed the bottom of the abyss, but now they had to try to restore some sense of duty and nobility in the people. Then he confided in them that they were expecting members of the government to arrive at any moment, their suites had been reserved the previous day, and that the ambassador of Bolivia was having to sleep on a billiard table. However, for him, Gabrielle Cotte, he would always manage to find something. More or less the same words he had used as a newly promoted deputy manager of the Normandy Hotel in Deauville at the height of the racing season. Cotte wearily passed his hand over his painful forehead. "My good man, you could put a mattress in the lavatory if you had to." All around him, everything was taking place in an appropriately discreet manner. There were no more women giving birth in a ditch. No more lost children, no more bridges blown up with such ill-calculated amounts of dynamite that they demolished the houses nearby. Here, windows were politely closed to keep out draughts. Doors were open for him. He felt plush carpets beneath his feet. "Do you have all your luggage? You didn't lose anything? Oh, what luck! People have been arriving without pyjamas, without even a toothbrush. There was one unfortunate gentleman who arrived with no clothes on. He was wounded in an explosion and made the entire journey from Tours completely naked, with only a blanket round him." "Well, I nearly lost my manuscripts," said Cotte. "Good gracious! How awful! But you found them intact?" "All the same, what you must have been through, what you must have been through! Excuse me, monsieur, excuse me, madame. Right this way. Here is the suite I have given you. It's on the 4th floor. I do apologize. You will excuse me, won't you?" "Oh," muttered Cotte, "nothing matters at the moment." "I do understand," said the manager, lowering his head and looking saddened. "Such a tragedy. I was born in Switzerland, but I am French at heart. I do understand." And he stood motionless for a few moments, his head down, like a mourner at a funeral who wants to rush to the exit but feels obliged to pay his respects to the family. He had put on this expression so often in the past few days that his kindly, chubby face had been transformed. He'd always walked and spoken softly, as befitted his profession. Now he exaggerated his natural tendencies even further, crossing the room utterly silently as if he were in a funeral parlour.
and when he said to Corte, "Shall I have breakfast sent up?" it was in a discreet and mournful tone of voice, as if he were looking at the body of a cherished relative and asking, "May I kiss him one last time?"
"Breakfast?" Corte sighed, returning with difficulty to reality and the trivial problems of everyday life. "I haven't eaten in 24 hours," he added with a faint smile. That had been true the day before, but not this morning. At 6 o'clock he had eaten a hearty meal. Nevertheless, he wasn't lying. He had eaten absent-mindedly, because of his extreme exhaustion and the concern he felt at the tragedy taking place in France. He felt as though he hadn't eaten.
"Oh, but you must force yourself, monsieur. I don't like seeing you like this, Monsieur Corte. You mustn't give in. You owe it to mankind."
Corte nodded in resignation. He didn't dispute his obligation to mankind, but at the moment he couldn't be expected to have more courage than the most humble citizen. "My good man," he said, turning away to hide his tears, "it is not just France who is dying. It is art as well."
"Not as long as you are here, Monsieur Corte," the manager replied warmly, as he had a great number of times since the fall of France. Corte was, in the list of celebrities, the 14th to arrive from Paris since the sad events began, and the 5th writer to seek refuge at the luxury hotel.
Corte smiled weakly and asked him to make sure the coffee was very hot.
"Boiling hot," the manager assured him,
then gave the necessary orders over the telephone and left. Florence had gone into her room, locked the door, and anxiously looked at herself in the mirror. Her face, normally so soft, so well made up, so rested, was covered in a shiny coat of sweat. It no longer absorbed the powder and foundation, but turned them into thick lumps like curdled mayonnaise. Her nose was pinched, her eyes sunken, her mouth pale and limp. She turned away from the mirror in horror.
"I could be 50,
she said to her maid. This was quite literally true, but she said it with such disbelief and terror that Julie took it as she should, that is to say, figuratively, as a metaphor for expressing extreme old age. "After everything that's happened, it's understandable. Madame should take a little nap."
"It's impossible. Soon as I close my eyes, I hear the bombs. I see the bridge again, the dead bodies.
Madame will forget."
"Never. Could you forget?"
"It's different for me."
"Why?"
"Madame has so many other things to think about," said Julie. "Shall I lay out Madame's green dress?"
"My green dress, with the way I look?"
Florence, who had slumped down into her chair with her eyes closed, suddenly rallied, summoning all her meagre strength like the head of an army who, despite needing rest and acknowledging the inefficiency of his subordinates, pulls himself together and, still weak with exhaustion, leads his troops onto the battlefield.
"Listen, this is what you're going to do. First, while you are running the bath, prepare me a face mask, number 3, the American one. Then telephone the hairdresser and ask if Luigi is still there. Tell him to come and give me a manicure in 3/4 of an hour. Then get my little grey suit ready with the pink linen blouse. The one with the collar.